It is Monday, August the 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. Coming up, can military action retake Mosul from the Islamic State?
To assume that military action will create a defeat of the ISIS is, I think, a very dangerous way of looking at things. We have allowed this particular movement to become a movement.
Also ahead, the fallout from Turkey's failed coup. Plus, who's voting for Trump for U.S. president? And what's trending on social media? Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Iraqi Kurdish forces say they have retaken five villages that are east of the Islamic State-held city of Mosul in an operation launched early on Sunday. Kurdish Brigadier General Dedawan Hershid Tofik described the operation outside Mosul as ongoing. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal tells VOA's Victor Beatty such a push by the Kurdish fighters was expected.
It was expected that it will happen sometimes after the summer period. These are more like the probing attacks, but the real attack is likely to come in late September, early October, as far as we understand. But it could very well have been moved faster, given the fact that things have changed quite dramatically in Syria. That may have accelerated the process. But the point is, I think most important thing to remember is what are the political forces or political events which are going to go along with this military action in order to get to control Mosul and kick out the ISIS. The point that I'm trying to make is, as General Petraeus has said several times, that in order for any action like this to succeed, we have to be quite explicit with respect to what is the political consequence of this. If the intention is to assure those people who are going to put their life online, particularly the Sunni tribes and the Peshmerga, that there will be a guaranteed exchange or a return to a better role and better future for them, it will not be possible to succeed in this military action. I have a feeling there is a sense that some sort of military, political rapprochement will have to be reached, and that some steps are being taken for that purpose, although it's not very clear as to when are they going to bear fruit.
Do you think that those political understandings may already have been reached?
Well, I think there has been a lot of talk on that front. The point is, when you start a military action without explicitly stating what are the underlying political commitments, it becomes very difficult and uncertain for the partners. So it could very well be that, given the fact that these are only probing actions, those political actions or political objectives have not been clearly identified or agreed upon. If they have not been, then it would be a bit dangerous to go only the political front unless the objective is a very short-term action, and that of showing success against ISIS.
Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi said the fall of Mosul would mark the effective defeat of Islamic State in Iraq.
No. Let me put it this way. Remember that Islamic State in Iraq or in the region itself has transformed itself from being a territorial activity or a territorial action into a movement. And that's the reason why you find them spreading all over the place. So to assume that military action will create a defeat of the ISIS is, I think, a very dangerous way of looking at things. We have allowed this particular movement to become a movement and move well beyond the idea of a territorial control. And therefore, unless a very explicit statement is made with respect to what kind of political dispensation will take place after the military action has been taken, it's not going to make life easier for Iraq, or for that matter, the Iraqi government.
What is the status of Mosul today? Do you think most civilians fled, and is the IS leader still there?
Oh, yes. They're still there. Quite a few civilians have left. They have been actually encouraged, as I understand, by the ISIS to leave, because they cannot look after them, number one. Number two, they are not secure as what you could call the human shield against attacks. So it's of no purpose and no interest to the ISIS to keep these guys over there. If they want to leave, they would rather let them leave, because they could actually be counterproductive if they're kept there. So my personal feeling is, on the basis of the information that exists at this moment, publicly or semi-confidentially, basically implies that They have learned a lesson from other places, the ISIS. They are not going to try to use these people as human shields. It hasn't worked for them, and they're not about to do this, given the fact that they're trying to move it, the ISIS towards a movement rather than a territorial action.
Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Thousands of Syrian civilians have returned to the ruined northern city of Manbij after U.S.-backed fighters drove the last Islamic State extremists from their stronghold near the Turkish border. This resident of Manbij said they had suffered because of the situation there, that there were no food, no utilities, no water. He said they're asking the people now in charge to clear their homes and cities of landmines. Extremists abandoned Manbij, retreating toward the IS-controlled border town of Zarabulus, along with nearly 2,000 civilians. It's not immediately clear whether those non-combatants exited Manbij as hostages or whether they had left voluntarily. Manbij was a strategically important link in supply lines to Islamic State headquarters in the Syrian city of Raqqa. Among the other stories we're following here on The Voice of America, new life, proof of life video showing dozens of kidnapped Chibok girls. Imam and his associate gunned down outside a New York mosque. Plus, Afghan officials see foreign fighters playing a key role in Helmand's fighting. Expanded coverage of those stories a lot more at voanews.com and as always on the VOA mobile app. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden will be visiting Turkey later this month, the first by a top Western leader since the attempted coup back on July the 15th. The trip comes at a time of strained relations between Ankara and Washington over demands that the U.S. turn over an Islamic cleric living here in the U.S., blamed for organizing the coup attempt. For some insight into the fallout from that attempted coup, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with Ambrin Zaman. She is a public policy fellow at the Wilson International Center for Scholars, and Nick Danforth, senior policy analyst at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Zaman was asked if she was surprised by the coup attempt.
I was totally taken by surprise, knocked off my chair. In fact, when word came of unusual activity on the Bosphorus Bridge, I was in Istanbul at the time, and I just crossed that bridge like half an hour prior to these reports. I thought that there must be a sort of high ISIS threat alert going on, something along those lines. And that's why these extraordinary measures were being taken, you know, to defend the bridge, Ataturk's mausoleum, etc. So, yes, highly unexpected. And how is it different from previous coup attempts? Well, the last hard coup attempt, or rather successful coup, was in 1980 when the military directly intervened and seized power. But since then, military intervention has taken the form of sort of strong admonitions to the governments that they didn't like, as in 1997 when they basically forced Turkey's first Islamist government out of power. The difference this time also is that this coup was prevented, and prevented by the people. The people took to the streets, and this is the first time in the history of modern Turkey that that's happened.
Turning to you, Nick Danforth, for your reaction to the coup. I know I myself watched it unfold on television through Twitter, and by the end of the evening, you know, it had ended. What are your takeaways from this and how it differs from previous attempts?
I think before this, a number of analysts, both in Turkey and abroad, had concluded quite confidently that there was no possibility of there being a coup in Turkey. And in a way, they were proven right to the extent there was not a successful coup in Turkey. I guess what people had implicitly assumed is that the people in the military who might stage a coup would have been wise enough to realize that absent popular support, absent, it appears, even enough support within the military hierarchy, it would be foolhardy to stage a coup. And through some combination of foolhardiness and perhaps desperation, they went ahead with it anyways. The nation, Turkish democracy, paid the price. But as Ambrin pointed out, it could have been far worse had people not come out on the street and actually, in many cases, quite courageously stood up to soldiers, tanks firing on them and, you know, prevented a takeover.
Indeed, an attack on the parliament as well. So back to you, Ambrin Zaman, to get to the factors that may have led to this and who may be behind it. Now, we're hearing a lot about this imam who was here in the United States in Pennsylvania, Fethullah Gulen. It appears that not just the government, but many Turks seem to implicate him. What are your thoughts with respect to who and what may be behind this coup and the timing of it?
Well, the who part is, again, something that sets this coup apart from the others, because for the first time we have a religiously inspired group, movement, whatever you want to call it, the government calls it a terrorist organization, implicated. And would I be surprised if they were involved? Not at all, because we have to look at the backstory here. There's been a steady sort of escalation in the Gulen movement's attempts to undermine the government ever since they sort of fell out. And we can trace that back to around 2011, when they called in Turkey's spy chief, Hakan Fidan. When I say they, prosecutors who were thought to be linked to the Gulen movement and were looking to lock him up over his alleged collusion with the PKK, the Kurdish group that's been fighting for self-rule in Turkey since 1984. So there's been this steady escalation taking aim at the government. You mentioned the corruption probe. And I'd also heard for some time that there were indeed officers, mid-level and even some generals inside the army who were closely affiliated to Fethullah Gulen. And we also know that the president, Erdogan, had been putting enormous pressure on the army chief, the previous army chief, Necdet Özel, and laterally on the current army chief, Hulusi Akar, to weed them out. But for some reason, they'd been resisting. And that's an interesting question. Why? Because you'd think that an organization that, you know, says there to defend secularism would surely want to get rid of, as it has in the past, anyone who holds faith or an Islamic leader, shall we say, above their loyalty to the state. So, yes, they seem to be involved, but what we need is solid evidence, obviously. And you mentioned the fact that the Turkish public seems to believe this. Well, they're being blasted with propaganda almost every day, telling them that this is what happened. And it's very hard to separate the facts from conjecture at this point. And this, of course, makes the relationship with the United States that much more difficult, but I'll leave it there.
Indeed, a very interesting response. Well, back to you, Nick Danforth, for your take on to what extent we know if Fethullah Gulen and his followers have anything to do with the coup. Again, you may want to add to who he is. He's an imam. I mean, he was close with Erdogan just up until 2011 or 2013 when things, you know, started to fall apart. Is this a power struggle at root? I mean, how do you see this?
Part of what's made this such an issue in U.S.-Turkish relations, and, you know, it does seem like we're moving towards a slow-motion train wreck over this issue, is that Turkey has been very insistent that the United States extradite Fethullah Gulen. Obviously, if it turns out he was implicated in leading this coup, that would be a very reasonable request. The problem is everyone in Turkey is completely convinced, not just members of his movement that were involved, but that he personally ordered and orchestrated it. No one in the United States is necessarily denying that. There's, I think, people, you know, everyone that I've talked to in D.C. seems entirely open to this possibility. But people, A, they want convincing evidence, and more particularly, if there's going to be an extradition, the United States legal system requires that there be enough evidence for a judge in Pennsylvania to decide that there's probable cause to let the extradition go forward. And what's been creating so much frustration is that the Turkish government seems to view this desire for evidence as an affront.
Nick Danforth of the Bipartisan Policy Center, he and Amran Zaman of the Wilson International Center for Scholars, speaking with my colleague Carol Castiel. She is host of the program Encounter. Get more of their conversation at voanews.com. Look under the red tab at the top of the page for Encounter. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Turning now to U.S. politics, in a policy speech later today, Republican Party presidential candidate Donald Trump is set to say how he would combat Islamic terrorism just days after claiming that President Obama and Democratic presidential contender Hillary Clinton made it possible for the Islamic State to exist. Meantime, Clinton has moved to roughly 7 percentage point advantage over Trump in the national political surveys. International Edition's Lori London speaks now with Justin Guest, a professor of public policy at George Mason University and author of the book The New Minority: White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. The subject of their conversation is Trump's popularity.
Yeah, Donald Trump has a very clear constituency that is numerous, and it was numerous enough to help him win the Republican primary, particularly because it was such an extraordinarily crowded field of candidates that if you had a plurality, a sizable minority of the voting public, you were going to do well enough because the votership was divided between 15 other candidates. The real question for Donald Trump is whether it will be enough to rely on that same constituency in order to win a general election with only one competitor. And I think that the conventional wisdom and, frankly, the math says that it's not. So the challenge that he now has in front of him is how does he build a Trump coalition with the backbone being white working class men, but not as many white working class women as well, along with other constituencies that add up to enough votes to win.
The one thing that has been clear is that the people that do follow him seem to be extremely loyal to him and are not bothered by any of the controversial statements that he makes.
That's absolutely right. And the reason why, Lori, is because these are folks who are not used to being represented publicly, affectionately, and affirmatively by mainstream politicians over the last 40 years. There was an era in American politics where the white working class was the heart and soul of the electorate, where politicians outwardly sought out their votes. And in over the last 40 years, as their numbers have diminished, as their power in unions have diminished, fewer and fewer politicians actually do that. So when someone like Donald Trump, with all of his status and all of his celebrity, says, "I care specifically about you," it's going to win you a lot of fans amongst a group of people who would otherwise felt really marginalized.
His opponent and opponents would argue that while these people may feel like he is in their corner, it's just not so. What do the facts say?
There have been many allegations that white working class people vote irrationally, that they don't vote with their interests. And I can tell you that that is wholly untrue. White working class know precisely why they're voting for Donald Trump. It's just not rational from the perspective of people who are not white working class. Rationality is really very much a subjective phenomenon, right? There are certain forms of rationality depending on the lens that you take. And many of the folks who accuse white working class people of being irrational are usually looking through an economic lens. Now, That was, I think, especially true given white working class support of Republicans in earlier election cycles.
That is Justin Guest of George Mason University speaking with my colleague, Lori London. Now it's time to see what's trending online with my colleague, G. Abby Lee. Hey, G, what's happening?
Hi, Steve. The trending hashtag for August 14th was hashtag Gay Uncles Day. The hashtag campaign originated from a Florida resident who wanted to normalize the role of the gay uncle, cousin, brother, etc. The hashtag gained popularity after Gay Star News reported on the idea. But the top Facebook comment to its article argues maybe that's unnecessary. He wrote, "I don't need a special day to validate that I'm a gay uncle. My nieces and nephews love me year-round. If I feel the need for validation, we have gay pride." Now moving on to another subject, this time involving politicians. A hacker who goes by the name Guccifer 2.0 posted personal information of just about every House Democrat on the internet. The information includes the officials' email addresses and mobile numbers. The information was released on WordPress, which announced the contents are now blocked as of Saturday.
I see, G. House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi sent out a warning letter to colleagues. Tell us about that.
Sure. After contact information was posted online, she reportedly received what she calls obscene and sick calls and text messages. She advised her colleagues to take precaution when answering phone calls and added she's now changing her mobile number.
And what's the public's reaction like?
The top comment to Gizmodo's Facebook post reads like this: considering the spying they do on us, I couldn't possibly care less. The commenter may be referring to the monitoring activity by the National Security Agency.
Anything else trending on social media today?
If you're upset about the hacking story, this might help offset the negative feelings. A cat in Pennsylvania named Batman got adopted from an animal shelter this weekend. Yes, that happens every day, but this story is trending because the 3-year-old feline has 4 years as opposed to just 2. It's a very rare genetic mutation. He was adopted from the Western Pennsylvania Humane Society within hours of the organization posting about him on its Facebook. The best part is that the little girl who adopted him loves superheroes. That's all for me today. Back to you.
Many thanks to you, G. Cat with 4 ears. That's amazing. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can find our program, International Edition, on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA scientists at its Goddard Institute for Space Studies found that some 2 billion years ago, Venus had temperatures that could have made it habitable and a shallow liquid water ocean. The findings were made with a computer model like one being used to predict future climate change here on Earth. Conditions on Venus today are anything but habitable. Described by many as having a hellish environment, our neighboring planet has an incredibly dense atmosphere of carbon dioxide that is 90 times thicker than our own. Surface temperatures there can reach 462 degrees Celsius. Some scientists speculate its closeness to the sun caused its oceans to evaporate. Since it was then left with no surface water, carbon dioxide filled the atmosphere, which led to what some call a runaway greenhouse effect that created present conditions. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. And now, what's going on at the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro? Fastest man in the world has won an unprecedented third straight Olympic gold medal in the men's 100-meter dash. Jamaica's Usain Bolt, who else would it be, came from behind to take the gold Sunday night, overcoming a poor start to catch American sprinter Justin Gatlin, who finished second with a silver medal. Canada's Andre de Grasse finished third and will take home the bronze. A few minutes earlier, South Africa's Wade van der Merwe set a world's record in the men's 400-meter final, finishing first. You can keep up with the Olympics at voanews.com. And some sad news. Kenny Baker, the actor who won worldwide fame as R2-D2, moved below trash. He was shaped as a robot, you remember, in Star Wars movie franchise. Well, he's died 2 weeks short of his 82nd birthday. He was short in stature, only 106 centimeters, but he said that made him perfect. Got parts that taller actors couldn't play. Born back in 1934 in Birmingham, England. From the world of music now, Glenn Yarborough, founding member of the folk trio The Lamblighters, has died. He was 86. Yarborough sang and played guitar with fellow Limelighters, the members of the band Lou Gottlieb and Alex Hasselhoff. That was from 1959 until 1963. Then Yarborough left the group in 63 and had a solo career that spanned nearly 40 years. He achieved his highest charting success with a 1965 song, Baby, the Rain Must Fall. It reached number 2 on Billboard's adult contemporary charts.
Some men climb a mountain, some men swim the sea. Some men fly above the sky. They are what they must be. But baby, the rain must fall. Baby, the wind must blow.
Sure, if you weren't around in 65, you'd definitely remember Glenn singing that song. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. We hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is just around the corner. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Glenn Yarbrough.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega is actively closing the country's democratic space in the run-up to the November presidential and legislative elections. Beyond silencing the political discourse and competition necessary for a vibrant democracy, such actions could have a stifling effect on Nicaragua's prosperity and international standing. The Nicaraguan Supreme Court, comprised of Ortega loyalists, stripped the opposition Independent Liberal Party from its long-recognized leader, Eduardo Montealegre. It took similar action on June 17th when it invalidated the leadership of the Citizen Action Party, another opposition party with the legal standing to present a presidential candidate. Then on July 28th, the Supreme Electoral Council removed 28 Independent Liberal Party National Assembly members from their popularly elected positions. The lawmakers decried the decision as a destruction of Nicaragua's already debilitated representative democracy by closing the last institutional space for the opposition. Other parties, like the Sandinista Renovation Movement, called the council's decision a new blow to completely liquidate political pluralism and to eliminate the opposition voices in parliament and public institutions that have played an important role in denouncing Ortega's abuses of power. Most recently, on August 2nd, the president named First Lady Rosario Murillo as his running mate in the November 2016 presidential elections. Murillo is viewed by many in Nicaraguan society as wielding substantial power, and speculation is that this has the potential of creating a family dynasty. President Ortega, who is running for a third consecutive term, says that he will not allow international election monitoring in November, despite polls showing that a vast majority of Nicaraguans believe that international observation would add credibility to the electoral process. Credible elections and political plurality are fundamental to any strong democracy, said U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby. Nicaraguan civil society, business leaders, and religious leaders continue to advocate for a strengthening of democratic institutions, a separation of powers, and a fair electoral process. The United States calls on the Nicaraguan government to respect the voices of its people and take the steps for fair and transparent elections that permit the full participation of all Nicaraguan citizens, including by allowing opposition parties to operate independently and by inviting the presence of international election observers. Without such steps, the credibility of the upcoming election will likely be questioned by many voices domestically and internationally.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.